Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 90. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Spotlight. And we're talking about Spotlight for a variety of reasons. The first is because it's Oscar season. So we're talking about all those films that really made an impact in 2015, and we wanted to cover them before it got away from us. We're also talking about it because it deals with some very serious issues. Even though this film isn't a documentary, it serves a lot of the same purposes. And makes us ask over and over, where do we go from here? So on this episode, I have on rector from the Church of the Redeemer in Greensboro, North Carolina, Alan Hawkins, and Elijah Davidson from Real Spirituality. Because both these guys, along with myself, have many, many thoughts on this movie. But mainly, we have lots and lots of questions after watching this film. It's a really great film, and it deserves to be talked about. So we do. On a slightly lighter note, we want to make sure you guys are checking out the website where you can check out notes and continue discussing this film. You can check out our Facebook page, our Facebook discussion group. If you're not part of our Facebook discussion group, please find it, request to join, we'll add you, and you can talk with lots of other real world guests and contributors about films such as Spotlight. So do that, follow us on Twitter, go to realworldtheology.com, subscribe to the podcast and whatever means you feel necessary, review the show, we really appreciate it. And keep listening, because you'll find more shows out on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month, along with our new show, Real World Rewind, hosted by Blaine Grimes, which will be out on the 15th of every month. So, as for this one is a really great show because we ask a lot of those questions. We don't have a ton of answers, but sometimes those are the best conversations to have. So here it is, episode 90, Spotlight and the Role of the Church. But we've all seen this movie now. We've all seen Spotlight. And we're all super happy. And we're doing cartwheels.
Yeah, feel-good movie of the year.
Yeah, feel-good movie. Super exciting. You know, we all left the theater probably with an extra skip in our step. So, I'm really glad that I have both you guys on. And I was actually telling Elijah this at another point that I try to be fairly strategic with who I have on the show, and it really depends on, you know, kind of what I think the themes might be, what I think the topics might be. And some movies that we discuss, we never know what the theme's going to be. We kind of have to dive into it. We kind of have to take apart some characters. We have to, you know, really analyze, you know, start, middle, finish, and then maybe even dive in deeper before we really pull out like a strong theme or kind of a truth that the movie might be trying to get at or a question it might be answering. And then there's movies like Spotlight, mm-hmm. where you only have to watch like the first 5 seconds of the trailer to understand kind of what kind of film you're going to be getting.
Yeah.
And I mean, from the very get-go, I knew that it had an all-star cast. And this seems to 2015 almost seems to be the year of the ensemble cast, not just like the you know, one known and a couple solid right. unknowns, but like, you know, Ruffalo, Keaton, McAdams, Schreiber, you know, this is like Stanley Tucci's in this. You know, like mm-hmm. you have a really solid cast. But usually when we talk about films that have tough themes like this, ultimately they're usually fiction, you know, like, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, this movie's going to tackle this really hard thing, but it's a made up story. And we don't really have to, we can talk about it very aloofly or very disconnectedly. In the case of Spotlight, though it's dramatized, you know, it's not a documentary.
Right.
There isn't anything fiction about the events that lead to the investigation. And I'm assuming we all kind of had a general understanding of what the film was, again, because you only have to watch about 5 seconds of the trailer. So, Elijah, something I'd ask you first is kind of how do you approach a film when you know that it's got a really good chance to like kind of hit you hard?
I don't know. I don't know that I approach them any differently than other ones. I don't think I do really. Mainly because I think I go into any movie that I watch hoping to be emotionally affected by it. You know, like I feel like if a movie's doing its job well, it's going to affect you emotionally in some way. And so I guess maybe if a movie like sets out to be like, oh, this is one that's going to really hit you, you know? And maybe I might actually go into it with a little more skepticism than normal. If it's being marketed as something that's going to hit you hard, you know? I'm not like any more hesitant to see it. I'm just a little more wary of it, I guess. Maybe it makes me expect more of it, you know?
Do you think any of that applied with Spotlight?
Not really, but I kind of like with The Hateful Eight, I tried to avoid with some of this stuff. I tried to avoid the marketing and stuff for some of these movies, because I don't like going in feeling on guard against them in any way, you know, as part of it. I mean, with Hateful Eight, I didn't want to know anything. With a movie like this, I don't want to be on guard. I want to be open to it, and so I tried to avoid anything about it. So I had heard that it was good. You know, I'd heard that Spotlight was good. I had heard that it was kind of low key and kind of straightforward. And so I guess I wasn't on guard for those reasons. But I don't know. I was hoping it would be a good movie. I guess that's true of most movies, though, you know?
I hope this movie is terrible. Well, I think the only time I thought that was when I was watching Zombievers. I was like, I hope this movie is terrible. And I was not disappointed. Okay, well, Alan, when I ask you kind of the same thing, I know you don't obviously get to see as many films as Elijah or I probably do, but when you know that you're going to in a movie that's especially well, with your profession, it's going to deal with the church, with clergy. Does that kind of make you think about it differently, or you just kind of go in saying, "I'm just going to take it for what it is. I'm not really going to think about it too much," or do you kind of mentally prepare yourself in some way?
I don't think I mentally prepare, but I'm certainly on guard and defensive because I think that whatever your field is or your vocation or your ideology, you know that your critics are usually not the best people to describe it or explain it. So, my thought process walking into this movie particularly was, I wonder how really bad they're going to have to make the Catholic Church look. And the ironic thing for me was they didn't. The Catholic Church looked really bad without any sort of commentary or
Without
slight.
really trying to pile on.
I didn't sense any piling on. So it was the opposite effect for me, which is I usually walk in defensive and then I dismiss the attacks. This time I walked in defensive and I was like, man, that's really sad. It's just really sad. So.
Well, so what would you I was gonna say, what would you say are some of the strengths of the film itself? But it sounds like you're already hitting on one where it's not really trying to nail the Catholic Church to the wall specifically. Well, what would you say that's a strength, or would you say, or what other strengths would you say it has?
I would say that it, like some of the other famous journalism movies, I felt like I was watching the real people, even though I'm sure there's not many journalists that look as good as Rachel McAdams. And, you know, I know Michael Keaton's face, obviously, from years and years, but I felt for the first time in a long time, this was the most believable of people I've seen on screen. I thought these were the real people. And that doesn't happen usually because they're characters, you know, they're actors, but I lost myself in that sense. I didn't think about Michael Keaton in previous movies.
You're like, why is Beetlejuice investigating? Right.
Mr. Mom.
Yeah.
So the whole time I'm watching these actors do a superb job, I'm not even thinking anymore about who they are and what they've played in. And
mm-hmm.
I'm finding myself lost in the incredible believability of their job, but the compelling and just the attention grabbing
mm-hmm.
film.
Yeah. So I think that's a really good point, because I noticed lots of the reviews I've read and the people that I've talked to have seen the movie. Even though you have this incredible ensemble that I've kind of already run down a little bit, mm-hmm. I didn't even hit on everybody, but the performances have been solid, but I think people have described them as not over the top. You know, nothing's like over dramatic. No performance is so large that it actually detracts you from what the story of what they're doing.
Precisely.
I think that's a great thing to point out. Elijah, like I said, I'd ask you the same question. What do you think are some of the biggest strengths of this film?
I think the one really great strength of this film is how it shows the systemic nature of the problem and the systemic nature of the solution.
Mm.
And that it and it's like really devoted to that. And I think that's part of what made any fears, Alan, that you would have had about it kind of laying on the Catholic Church, that just dissipated.
Yeah,
because it spreads it all out. The blame is everywhere in Boston,
mm-hmm.
Right down to the reporters that are reporting on this story. You know,
yeah.
Like it's very important that Robbie was the one in charge of the city beat when they glossed it over the first time. You know,
that's right.
Like
yeah.
Everyone's to blame. But also, like the solution is also systemic. It took the whole team of people, this ensemble of people. It took the lawyers that were willing to finally tell the truth about mm-hmm. what they had done. You know, it took, it took everybody. It took all the people who called in afterwards, after the story came out and reported other abuse, you know, to actually get the problem brought to light and start working toward the fix. And, you know, like McCarthy is a very low-key director, even in his other really good films, like The Visitor. That I think are really great. He's a very low-key director, not flashy at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it really served the story really well. He has a lot of restraint. Shows a lot of restraint. He even doesn't let characters there's like three characters in this movie that a typical movie would have let kind of take over the film.
Yeah.
One is Liev Schreiber's Marty Baron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's the outsider that comes in and kind of stirs things up.
He's shaking things up.
He's a gunslinger, you know, like if this is a Western, he's the gunslinger that comes in and fixes stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
but they really limit his involvement, his screen time to what was only necessary, you know, and that helps a lot. The other one is Garabedian, Stanley Tucci's character.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy that's been on a crusade for a while. Like you can imagine what's a good example? Like a kind of a cheesy Sandra Bullock movie about a lawyer like this, you know, mm-hmm. that like keeps pounding, costs him everything kind of thing. And the other one, the other character that I found really compelling that they very wisely keep even off the screen entirely, is Richard Seip, the ex-priest, who gives them the percentage that really is that little push they need to figure this whole thing out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a fascinating person.
Mm-hmm.
Ex-priest, married to a nun, spent 30 years working in psychology on this exact issue.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, he's been completely vilified and ostracized by the Catholic Church for a long time and others. He's a really fascinating character, and they don't even put him on screen. And in real life, he actually met with the reporters in person. So that was a really wise move, I think, by McCarthy to keep him off screen. It's Richard Jenkins. It's his voice, by the way, which is fun if you're a fan of The Visitor. And mm-hmm. So that's what I think the movie's real strength is in spreading everything out over everybody in Boston,
mm-hmm.
Both the problem mm-hmm. and the solution. You know,
mm-hmm.
We also only see one priest. We see two priests, I guess. There's that little kind of flashback scene at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
But there's no lines there for that priest. But then the one priest that we do meet, is the one that Rachel McAdams, that Sasha Pfeiffer knocks on the door and just like happens upon, who has actually abused children. And if you notice, like that one priest that they do feature, he himself is a victim of the system, and the system that doesn't allow these priests to get help.
Yeah.
You know, like they kind of like go out of their way to make sure you see that the priests too are victims mm-hmm. of the system that allowed it to continue. It's just really smart.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, so, and with that, I want to make sure that we say, as we typically do on every episode, that we're going to be talking about this entire film. Because this film is based on actual events, unfortunately, we kind of already know how this film ends. So there's not really any surprises. And actually, so, you know, there's reviews that point that out, that it's interesting how you can make such a good film that's not over-dramatized when you know the ending.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, like there's no surprises.
Yeah.
Yet I feel like we're still surprised.
Right.
You know, because we, it reminds me, and I think I was talking to Alan about this earlier today. This reminds me of, for those, well, I almost don't want to make this cause it's technically a spoiler for something else. All right. So if you haven't seen the movie Calvary, don't listen to this part, but it reminds me a lot of the movie Calvary. And you know, all of us are familiar with, but because you have to have been living in a cave, like somewhere where they don't even make caves or something, and there's a rock in front of it and you can't move it. It doesn't matter. Biblical imagery. So should have not heard that there is scandal in the Catholic Church. All right. And we're all like, oh, that's so bad. That's so bad. Do you think that's bad? Yeah, that's terrible. Do you think? Yes, I also think it's terrible. We all agree on this. But in this scene at the very end of Calvary, when the priest's would-be killer confronts him, he finds out that the priest tells him that his dog was killed, and he asks him if he cried when his dog died, and he said yes. And then his would-be killer says, when you heard about all the children that were being molested and raped by priests, did you shed a tear? And he said no.
Hmm.
And it's that disconnect that we have hearing about this story, but then having to watch people slowly uncover. And every time we think they're at the end of the story and they've found the maximum number of involved priests or clergy, it always gets one step bigger. It always hurts one step further. And, it, you know, Elijah, you've talked about how part of the strength of it is kind of how they handle such like a sensitive and important topic. You know, like the narrative itself managed to stay very, very neutral. Or at least in my opinion, it did. And, as Alan said, the facts kind of allow us to make our own moral judgment. The movie doesn't seem to try to make a moral judgment. Some of the characters have outrage, but like you said, Elijah, there's no priests on screen that we're mad at, really. There's no there's no really person to aim our hatred towards. There's no real super evil priest who's intentionally doing super evil things. Intentionally diabolical, mm-hmm. like a bad guy of right. a movie. Obviously, covering up things is morally wrong, and you know, I'm not trying to say that that's not right. And see how careful we have to be just talking about it. But would you say that being completely neutral, or well, let me back up, Elijah. I would ask you: do you think the film you could describe this film as completely neutral, and kind of why? And do you think it helped overall, or this story could have been told a different way?
Well, I don't know that neutral is quite the right word.
Okay.
To use. I wouldn't say that. I mean, the film is outraged, you know, like
mm-hmm.
it is, but there's no debate about this, right? Like there's no one out there who's like, yeah, it's totally okay to abuse kids. Like there's no one like that, you know? And so the movie didn't have to go out of its way to convince you of the injustice, you know, like it didn't have to do that. It doesn't have to be like, it doesn't have to be Blood Diamond, you know, Blood Diamond. You've seen right. Blood Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like, it doesn't have to convince you that buying diamonds is wrong.
Yeah.
This movie didn't have convinced you that priests abusing kids is wrong. Everybody knows that. Everyone agrees with that. It's terrible. So the movie can, as it does, just it matter of fact is how I would put it. Not neutral, but just very matter of fact about everything. And I think that is necessary, because if it was overly sentimental, you would get people who would feel like it was just an attack on the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Or people would say it's taking advantage of a situation just to make money off a movie, you know? Yeah. But it doesn't. It's just very matter of fact. It talks about it straight and as it needs to be talked about. Yeah.
Mm. Well, and I guess I'd like to know what you think about this too, Alan. But at one point, when I walked out of the theater, I kind of had this thought that I almost wanted there to be some voice for the church that was kind of like, we're not okay with this. And not everyone in the church is trying to cover this up. Like, there are other options. And I think that goes back to actually what you said, Elijah, about that, you know, that there's the one guy who, you know, ended up marrying the nun and gave him the percentage and stuff like that. And I think I wanted more of him, even though it's hard to argue that maybe he was best left off the screen and not really diving into his character, because it makes it more not controversial, but polarizing, I guess.
Yeah.
So, Alan, I mean, I'd ask you kind of like a very similar question. Like, if not neutral, would you agree with kind of how Elijah's describing it? Would you say that maybe there's a neutrality in who the blame goes to?
I had maybe a different experience. I felt like the movie was not neutral. I felt like it was actually, it had a disdain, a slight disdain to it. You notice all of the characters were former Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
The only character in the movie that saw the goodness of the church in a naive way was the grandmother.
Mm.
You know, the pitiful examples of think about all the good the church does,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah, blah. That was just terrible. So, and to be honest, I actually don't think this movie needed someone to kind of redeem the church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At one level, I think this story needed to just be appalling, because chances are most people, like myself included, did not read much about the Roman Catholic scandals. We just went, oh, that's terrible. Oh, those poor people. We want justice. But mm-hmm. we really didn't look into why it happened, what happened, kind of like you're referencing just a few minutes ago. So I was actually at one level thankful there wasn't someone on screen trying to redeem or...
Yeah.
I don't think they could have done it,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. I think it would have been a failed character attempt.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, actually, I want to take what you said one step further, because when you were describing that for just a second, I took myself out of what you were saying in regards to it being about the outrage being about the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
and or the, you know, the indifference, like, oh, we should do something, we want justice, and then kind of moving on, and thought about that's actually, to me, it seems how we react to everything.
Yeah.
You know, like we hear a news story about something that happened in a foreign country. Oh, we're outraged. But then the next thing comes along and we forget about it.
Right.
We never actually read about why it happens or how it happens or how these people are people. It happens with, you know, acts of atrocity in other countries.
Sure.
It happens with acts of atrocity here.
Well, I think it was appropriate for them to let, even though it was a sideline issue,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad it got into the movie. They let 911 interrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So it was this tangent, which took all national focus and mm-hmm. news cycle attention to Islamic jihadism, instead of the terror and just the trauma of what happened in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fitting, and I would love it to know from the director if that was intentional, if they really thought through,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're letting 911 and that coverage interrupt this movie, so you can see that 911 actually interrupted
mm-hmm.
the story that was going on, mm-hmm. because I vaguely remember it. Yeah. And then it was gone.
Yeah. And it, well, and that's the thing too, having to make decisions like that, because you don't want it buried or just lost.
Right.
You want to make sure that when you're reporting on something that's serious,
yeah,
that it gets the full attention that it deserves.
Exactly.
And this is, and as you know, the movie kind of points out, it has that big AOL billboard. This is really right before the internet takes off.
Yeah.
In a serious way, and so, but it's still kind of alluding to the fact that our attention spans are going to grow shorter and shorter.
Right.
And shorter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to, Alan. Actually, what you're saying about the Catholic Church and how the film feels about the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
I do think you're right that there's not anyone in the movie that defends it.
Right.
And I like what you say about how that's probably a good thing, actually, because it would just feel small and hollow. What I found as interesting in this film, as the story itself, and the look at journalistic excellence that you kind of see in their investigative journalism, is this, it's almost a mournful thread about not being able to trust the institution anymore. The movie's sad about it. The characters are sad about it, that they can't trust them. There's a conversation that, that Sasha and Mike, Mark Ruffalo and Rachel McAdams have about the church, and how I think Mike says something like, you know, I thought it was always going to be there for me and I would go back to it one day.
Yeah.
And this just makes me not be able to do that, you know, and he's sad about that.
Yeah.
Like really sad about it. And Sipe on the phone, you know, he asked him at one point, he's like, how do you call yourself a Catholic or whatever, knowing all that you know, or something. He asked him something.
How do you
like
take
that.
The mass?
Yeah.
He asked him if he still takes the mass.
Right. How do you do that? And, you know, he says, I try to think the church as a temporary institution and then the church as the eternal thing that we're connected to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like this movie really is, like, really, whether it's McCarthy and Singer, the screenwriters, or what, but just really wrestling with how you stay committed to an institution, even if you know that the institution commits injustice and covers it up and to such a degree. Like I think that's the emotional through line for the film, for me anyway, that I find most compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you're basically asking all Americans how they can be proud to be Americans.
Yeah.
By saying it the exact, you know, just take it out and replace it.
Yeah.
It's
for that reason that I think this movie and The Big Short work really well together, because they both tear down your faith in institutions and ask you how you can still be a part of it.
Right.
If you see what it does. Yeah.
Well, there must be some kind of thread in that, because when I knew this movie was coming out, I really wanted Alan to see it and get his thoughts on it. And then I just recently told Alan that he really needed to watch The Big Short too. So apparently I think that Alan's a sucker for institutional teardowns.
It's a very pressing question though. Like that institutional distrust, you know, is a huge thing in our society right now.
I was going to say, and because of that, I feel like that you have one of two options, and one is to just ignore it, and the other one is to leave, you know, but you can't, as long as humans are creating institutions.
No, there's a third option, but go ahead.
Oh gosh. So I'm setting up this question.
Yeah.
And hopefully your answer will be the third option. Cause I would say a lot of people, especially Christians and Christian institutions, kind of would see this entire movie as something that they'd want to either deny.
Yeah.
Kind of like as we see in the film, you know, lots of people are like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, you know, they're trying to cover it up, or they'll just move on, or like many of us, incidentally, without any malice, just forget about it. So do you think it's best for people to have to confront a film like this? Because I'm assuming it seems like we all think that people need to see this film. But like, what good is that going to do if they need to confront it?
You asking me this first?
Yeah, sure.
Or Alan?
You're on Skype, so usually Skype gets to go first.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably going to make a t-shirt that says, like, you know, Real World Theology on the back and just say Skype gets to go first.
Right. There you go.
So
could you repeat your final question again, actually? Sorry.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I was too busy forgetting that this question was happening, denying that it exists. Well, I say, like, so I would imagine some of the ways to get past this is deny it or forget.
So why
about
watch
it.
This movie?
Yeah, like, so yeah. Do you think it's best for people to have to kind of confront things like this and admit that they happened? And if they do, like, what benefit could that have?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do. I think it's important for people to confront things like this, especially Christians, because, you know, this is not just a Catholic problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not. I was talking with my boss, Rob Johnston, here, and, you know, he was the dean of a seminary for a while before he came to Fuller, a different seminary, and they had multiple cases of this among their student body. Mm-hmm. That he had to deal with. He was on the board for a major denomination that dealt with cases like this for a long time too. So it's not just a Catholic problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if I, rather than leave the institution or not think about this kind of stuff, if it's going to get fixed, it's going to happen from the inside of the institutions. You know, mm-hmm. I would say it. If one of the many things that the incarnation teaches us is that change comes from the inside, change comes from the inside of anything. Like outsiders can encourage change, they can spark change, kind of like Marty Baron does here in this movie. But the real change has to come from the people who are completely tied into the system itself. And so if the church is going to address this problem, fix this problem, it's going to be because Christians like you and I stay committed to the church and work to fix these things from the inside. And, you know, I think that having that eternal view is also super important because we have to acknowledge that it's not up to us ultimately. If it's going to be completed, it's going to be by people who come after us and ultimately by God who will make all things right. And you have to have that long view and that short-term view of seeing the problem. At the same time.
Well, I like what you're kind of pointing out, kind of God's role in hopefully changing the hearts of people and working in the situation, because it was pointed out that God himself is actually rarely mentioned in the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is pretty appropriate because I remember writing this out and just kind of like almost rolling my eyes when I wrote it out, but you know, God had nothing to, well, you know, God wasn't the one that did this.
Right.
And I think of like all my, my more excitable atheist friends who would be like, oh, okay, so he didn't do it. So he didn't stop it. So how's that not still his fault and kind of stuff like that. But, to me, it just points to the fact that again, like as long as humans are creating institutions, they're going to have the same problems that humans have. And I would say that we all agree that humans have a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those problems can sadly lead to the terrible things that we see in this film and more. Because it was, I think it was the review over at Decent Films talked about how something that they don't really mention in the film is that the, you know, the numbers that they come to for cases of molestation or rape aren't so different in with like the Catholic Church or, you know, Christianity in general as they are in any other profession. Anytime where you have like authority figures over other people, it's just that people are kind of, you know, it's more of a scandal when the church does it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Expect more.
Yeah. Yeah. You expect a little bit more.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also think that the helpful part of the film was, and Mikey, you might have mentioned this earlier, no institution was let off the hook.
Yeah.
So the journalistic institution was implicated, even by former Catholics, unchurched folks, you know, they were implicated.
Mm-hmm.
The legal system was implicated. I mean, it was the police department was implicated. So all these segments of society are broken. And to that degree, I don't I don't know if people would have walked away from the movie seeing that, because the focus was obviously the institutional corruption of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think this is a great movie to just show the utter brokenness of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, it's not just a Roman Catholic problem. It's a human problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual abuse occurs in every segment of society and every demographic. So,
yeah.
To that degree, I think,
and not that justifies it within the church,
not at all. It's obviously worse in the appearance because it's in the name of God,
mm-hmm.
yep.
versus just in the failure of humanity.
Yep.
But I did think if there was a glimmer of hope, it's that no institution is safe.
Yeah.
And woe is us. I mean, who will rescue us, sort yeah. of thinking.
Well, I like that for two reasons. One, because it harkens back to one of the very first things Elijah said,
mm-hmm.
which is that it's systemic.
Exactly.
You know, it's not like one person did a bad thing and everyone's, you know, it's huge and he's doing it by himself. It's
right.
everybody. And the second thing is, when it's everybody, it's one of the best examples of the confession that we say every week,
mm-hmm.
when we say, you know, for the things that we've done and the things that we've left undone.
Yeah.
And this is a wonderful case of people who think, I didn't do it.
Right.
So my hands are clean in some way.
Right.
Or at least to some degree, but those are the things that these people have left undone. And right. even when if we take it a step further, because it's such an encompassing confession, it even applies to us, our own basically willful ignorance,
mm-hmm.
of something that should be a much bigger problem.
Yeah.
I mean, given everyone has limited bandwidth to, you know, be on so many, not bandwagons, but, you know, kind of
causes.
Platforms and
yeah.
causes. So we can't all be on every cause, but,
right.
you know, at some point, if, you know, we care about the church.
Justice.
And justice.
Yeah.
I
think there was I might be giving away my favorite part of the movie. I have two, but I think the most amazing part of the movie for me, or the turning point, was mm-hmm. when Michael Keaton's character was asked, why are you doing this, by his attorney friend, Jamie Sheridan's mm-hmm. character. And he said, because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, there was this moment when I think his true humanity came out, which is, this is the right and good and just thing to do, even though it's going to cause lots of problems and lay waste to people and careers and all that. I thought that was just, that was the best part of the movie. Like, someone in the sea of compromise and brokenness stepped up to the table and said, I'll do it. And that's what it took, really,
yeah.
I think.
Well, it took a couple of people doing something very similar.
It did.
It looked different. But, you know, it's like you said, we've said, like, Liev Schreiber's character had to come in and say, I'm not just going to toe the line. I'm going
right.
to be, what did you say, Elijah? The gunslinger?
Editorial gunslinger.
The editorial gunslinger. Yeah. So, you know, it took a couple people not thinking the status was quo.
Yeah.
So,
and that's where I think Michael Keaton was the hero of a pretty sad movie.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a hero character in this movie.
Well, yeah. And I think that's, well, I don't want to get to that right yet, because that's kind of what I would describe as my favorite moment. So I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I'll ask you this instead. In her review, Sister Helena Burns, I think she does a great job, I mean, as a Catholic, running down all the things that we need to see this movie, or reasons we need to see this movie, and some of the things that kind of need to be thought about moving forward.
Hmm.
But she points out that the movie ends before we really get an epilogue. I mean, we get like a little bit of an epilogue, like this person did this or
right.
this went on to this, but not much of like healing. There's there's little hope. There's almost no healing that we get to see in the movie. And so, Alan, especially, I really wanted to ask you, because this is a hard topic. I know that, like, because of your profession, like, you have to be extra careful about perception, I mean, and reality, you know, there are precautions that you probably have to take mm-hmm. because that other professions would not have to take because of things like this. But after all the church scandals and pastor meltdowns and cheating and stealing and everything that the church has been known to do, which, again, so has all of society,
mm-hmm.
not to defend the church, but to point out that it's systemic. whether it's what you personally need to do, or if you're counseling someone who's been a victim of sexual assault mm-hmm. or something like this, like, when the church is just as culpable an institution, what place does the church have in that healing? Like, where can the church go from here?
Oh, wow. I would be out of my forte because I haven't actually had to counsel many folks who are sexual abuse survivors mm-hmm. from the church context.
I've yeah.
counseled several from family or school systems or whatever. So I think that what you constantly have to do in our vocation, my vocation, is to remind people of what the church truly is and what the church truly isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there was a point when they were interviewing Phil Salviano. Is that right? Mm-hmm. The truth teller guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how his line made the trailer, and he says, how can you say no to God, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a false understanding of the true nature of the church that acts of God's people are always acts on behalf of God. Mm-hmm. So I think that the church actually has one of the best roles, because it should be able to explain in the best way what it truly is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, where healing comes for people, when they see this wasn't the act of the church, although the church was corrupt and complicit.
Mm-hmm.
This was the act of sinful people doing sinful things. And if you don't know the nature of what the church is and what the church isn't, you confuse those things. And that's where the hurt happens. So there's a lot of damage done in the church and by the church. And my experience, not in these situations, sexual abuse, but in others, is to tell people what the church really is
mm-hmm.
and why what they experienced wasn't really the church. It was the fallenness of man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the healing role the church has. Now, when leaders of the church don't embrace that because they're sold out to power or corruption or compromise, then the church ceases to be a healing place. So many people turn to counseling outside of the church
mm-hmm.
or therapy outside of the church. And, you know, if you've done the background on this guy, Richard Sipe, he got blistered by the church,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he concluded, I was reading some of his stuff, he concluded that the church still is the best place for healing,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. So I found that ironic
yeah.
in
yeah.
his writings, that it still is the best vehicle for it. It's just so corrupt right now, it has to be reformed,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think was what you were alluding to, Elijah. There's the stay in and be complicit. There's the bolt mentality, but then there's the reform from within system.
Yeah.
And that's where, when reformation happens, the church actually becomes a healing agency.
Hmm.
So
that's really good.
Sorry, it was long-winded.
No. I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted an honest answer.
All right.
Because I feel like I said, people who are going to wrestle with this movie are going to want an honest answer.
Exactly.
I mean, it's the answer that, like, you know, Mark Ruffalo's character.
Yeah.
He needs to sit down and have that conversation with somebody.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if he would be even willing, you know, yeah. And how would you even convince him?
Right.
You know? So, but I'd ask Elijah, I'd ask you if you had anything that you wanted to add to that. Like Alan pointed out, you already kind of talked about the need, or the ability to, if change is going to happen, it kind of has to happen from within. Do you see any other role that the church has after things like this, or systemic problems in society?
I can't really add much more to what Alan said. That's good.
I read it somewhere and just memorized it.
He's like Jonathan Edwards over here. He's got a really tiny little piece of paper and he's just reading it. It's great.
I guess all I would say is, speaking more from a film critic, is don't be afraid of movies like this.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Don't be afraid of movies like this. And you'll be surprised sometime the grace that you find in them, because the filmmakers are often wrestling with the same things. That's why they made the movie.
That's right. No one would really just set out to make money.
Yeah.
To make a movie like this.
Yeah. Right. Obviously, I don't know exactly what the conversations were. I mean, none of us really know what the exact conversations that happened in each of the rooms that were depicted in this movie. But because of the tone of the overall film, often I can tell, or I have a pretty good inkling of who, the writer is in the movie, because usually the voice of the writer comes through in one or two characters. Either because two people are fighting, or one person kind of is the moral backbone of the film,
mm-hmm.
or the person who keeps bringing people back to the center. Because this movie, like I said, because of the tone of the movie, it seemed like anytime I saw Mark Ruffalo's character on screen, he seemed to be getting more emotional than almost anybody.
Yeah.
And he was I think he was the closest to outrage. I think everyone was outraged in their own way, but in a movie that has a pretty, not dumbed down, but, softer tone than you would expect from an over-dramatized, we're going to get the bad guys kind of, film dealing with these type of topics. He seemed to be the guy that was just kind of hurt and confused. Which is where I could see someone who was able to write this film was coming from,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, he's definitely the biggest character, mm-hmm. you know, in the movie, capital C character. And we'll make it some of that stuff in a minute. I did hear an interview on NPR with the real Walter Robinson, Robbie Robinson, the character mm-hmm. Michael Keaton plays, and he talked about how much time these actors spent with these reporters.
Oh, wow.
And learned what they were like. And he said it was weird sometimes, because he'd watch the movie and Michael Keaton would say something and it would sound it sounded like himself. Like, it was weird that they did such a good job kind of mm-hmm. embodying these real people. And so I just imagine that Mike Resendez, that's how Mike Resendez is, a little bit more emotional, a little quirky, all that kind of, a little more bulldog.
Well, didn't he say he was Portuguese too? So he's he's got the fire engine of the Portuguese. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know that we're going to be on a little bit of a time constraint, so I wanted to go ahead and wrap up. Even though, I mean, I know we could continue talking about the minutia of this film and the nuance and other words that make me sound smart for quite a while, but I wanted to kind of start heading us home a little bit. So we do this by talking about things that didn't really sit right within the movie. And it's really hard to say that in a film like this, when hopefully the entire film didn't really sit right. But but this is where we can kind of take a thematic step back, maybe, or a moral step back, and we can kind of look at it with a critic's eye and think of maybe things that could have been done better, or things that didn't fit with mm-hmm. with the way that the movie was done critically, or something that maybe took away from the greater theme that we saw there. So, Elijah, I'd ask you, what would be your kind of come on moment or thing that didn't really sit right with you?
Oh, that's pretty easy for me with this movie, actually. I've seen it 3 times now, mm-hmm. but the thing that I don't like how they handled it at all was the way that they handled John Slattery's character, Ben Bradley, Jr. They kind of it's not really an insinuation. They kind of make you think that he's the bad guy that buried the story a long time ago, and he's trying to mess him up the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a red herring, like a little misdirection thing. I don't know why they did that. Like, I think maybe they were trying to let you feel the paranoia that the reporters felt when they were working on it, just knowing that there are forces against them getting this story out or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was just a little bit schlocky, for lack of a better word, to kind of have you suspect this guy the whole time,
right.
You know,
and
really nothing come of it. So I didn't like that at all. I don't, every time I watch it, I don't like that. It distracts me from what's going on in the movie. So that's definitely my come on moment in the movie.
Gotcha.
Especially the time when the knock on the door happens in the middle of his conversation with Sipe. Resendez's conversation with Sipe and Slattery.
Yeah, I thought that was – he's going to say –
yeah,
bury it, you know. Let's know. Just forget the article or whatever.
So
I didn't even think about that. Now now you have to watch that again. So Alan,
okay, so I think the part that I just went was when Sasha and her grandmother were in church and they had the priest up there and he's talking about how on the internet basically everything is fair game now or something to that effect, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's all out there now because of the internet. So his sermons could be fact checked or whatever. And I just felt like that was unnecessary or a come on moment because we had just gone through looking at the conversation about these priests and it hadn't come into full bore gear yet, but then they put up a priest. And so the whole time I'm wondering what kid is he molesting? Yeah. You know, I just thought that was unnecessary. Hmm. You know, what did that accomplish? That was my, oh, come on moment.
Yeah.
They were, you know, that was like one of the other threads of the movie that a lot of critics and journalists have attached themselves to is this whole, like, the end of real journalism, like the advent of the internet age and all that kind of stuff, you know? Like, that was one of those moments that, that just, I don't think it needs it.
Yeah, I didn't
so much, you know? Like, the story didn't need that so much. I mean, it probably got this movie more awards doing it that way and more critical praise by having that stuff in there. Because it gives all these people who used to work for newspapers a chance to say how important newspapers were and supporting good journalism and stuff, you know?
Yeah. But
with a story like this, like even the AOL billboard that you mentioned earlier. I'm like, really? I mean, okay, fine. Like, pretty obvious, you know, what you're
I think there. That was a throw in after the movie was done. Like, oh, let's add this here.
Digitally inserted. It looks digitally inserted.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. There have been no AOL billboard that had been that clean.
No. Been pixelated.
Well, let me take what you said a step further, Alan, and I would say the thing that, because I read it and I guess I was looking for it, and that's the problem. When they tried to give our journalists like personal lives, it wasn't a complete throwaway, but occasionally it seemed like they were trying too hard to push something with their personal lives, and then they never really went anywhere with it. I mean, there was a little bit of stuff there with the grandma, because it kind of shows a different view of Catholicism, or someone who has a, you know, they're not on the inside investigating the story,
right.
So they don't know. But like, kind of being like, oh, honey, I'm late, or I guess you didn't go home again, or, you know, like, it was...
Well, he tells Sasha at one point, go home and spend time with, was the guy's name Huss, her husband? Like,
yeah.
Well, that's the point, it didn't matter.
Yeah, it didn't matter.
You know, because he'd be there, and then he could, it wouldn't matter.
Right.
And I don't know, it seemed like they were trying to be like, remember, these people are human. And I'm like, I think we already know. Like, I didn't need that to.
I did not suspect their humanity.
I
think that was also there because of the journalism thing. Like, I felt like in every of those, each one of the circumstances, they were showing you the cost that it took from these people to be good investigative journalists. Like, it cost them their personal life, you know, like Mike Resendez is living in a little place that he's renting because he's on the outs with his wife because he works too hard all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is going to put a drive a wedge between Sasha and her grandmother. You know, like all that kind of stuff. I thought it was part of the journalism thing more. Yeah. Like there's a cost to it. Yeah, which doesn't quite work.
Didn't work. All right.
But if that's our worst complaint.
Yeah, I mean, but if that's, really, if that's our worst complaint. Yeah. I would say those are the kind of complaints we have because, again, not that we're coming out of this theater with a skip in our step, but it's still really well done.
The movie's well done.
And I think it does exactly what it needed to do, maybe even better than it thought it could.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're obviously going to hear about it awards time. It already has been nominated for a number of Golden Globes. We'll find out, at the time we're recording this, we'll find out very soon, if it's nominated for any Oscars for any performances or overall, but, anything that it gets, it probably is deserving because I'm sure we have favorite moments. And again, much like our come on moments, I gotta have to couch this in a much different way with such a heavy film. Obviously we're not jumping for joy when we leave the theater. But there are things that we notice are done incredibly well, that draw us to the story.
Yeah.
And so Elijah, what were kind of some of those things that you really connected with one of the three times that you watched it?
the scene that the edited together, scenes of Resendez and Pfeiffer interviewing the two abuse victims.
Mm-hmm.
Cause they're like concurrent conversations where they're edited together. I think those are so well done. I mean, they're emotional, you know, like I understand, like I'm sure they wanted to give a face to the victims, you know, by doing that. Plus they had to show how these reporters did their job, like how they started getting to the bottom of what was going on, you know? But I really liked the way that was done, and in large part because in both cases, the abuse wasn't like all at once, you know, it was like small things over time that led up to just complete sexual abuse, you know, but there were small things before that led up to it. And I just thought that was a really good way to show that even these specific situations of abuse, there was a systematic method to it, that it wasn't all at once. I thought that was really great.
Yeah.
Really well done.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that my other favorite thing in the movie was, the courtroom scenes with Mike when he was trying to get the files all the civic red tape and stuff that he had to go through, because it just, I mean, it's a little bit of an obstacle. It gives the movie a little bit of, kind of, is he going to get it in time kind of thing, you know, when you know he is, but it felt urgent, you know?
Yeah.
And, I used to work for an engineering company on a survey crew. And so we did a lot of things with the city and government offices and trying to get files and all this stuff all the time.
And it's really helpful.
It's exactly like that. It's like, I mean, I felt so sorry for people who worked in those offices because, you know, they don't really like it very much. And they have to go through all the red tape all the time and everything they do, you know, that they just kind of stick to the rules and you do what they say and it's maddening and it's 1,000 offices and it's always that way. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Alan?
Okay. So, you know, I just wanted to hate the attorney, Eric
McLeish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything about him. I mean, they just did him well. And the character, Billy Crudup, he's got the slick hair. He's in a nice office. You know, he's wearing a great suit. And yet my favorite part of the movie was when they think they've got him and he basically says, I sent this stuff 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I mean, I liked it because it was at least a character in the movie that was bad, you know, that you wanted to hate, who had redemption. Like he had a sense of justice,
mm-hmm.
which I'm wondering, you know, if that would have compromised his career, actually.
Yeah.
Doing that, leaking case stuff and knowledge. So it was, I really liked that part of the movie. I mean, there were a number of others, but that was probably the one I went, yes, there is another good guy. You know, the journalists, you are assuming they're the good guys.
Yeah.
And everyone else is complicit. But for him to say, I did this 5 years ago, you guys need to check your records.
Yeah.
Was good news. And then they showed the clipping and the document he sent. And so that was my favorite part.
Well, I see. Yeah. So I would take that again a step further for my favorite moment and say that almost every time you think there's a villain, and Elijah, you pointed this out kind of too, in your come on moment, say like the movie kind of is like, nope, not really.
Right.
It's still everybody.
Yeah.
You know? So my favorite moment is turning that around and saying at the same time, even though Alan, you kind of pointed out a little bit that Robbie kind of ends up being a hero in like a scene, like overall, like no one wins.
Yeah.
You know, like if you made this, like if you try to tie a bow on the story, like when they finally publish this article and they're getting all the calls, you have the guy running down the aisle, like doing the pump fist in the air, being like, we just broke this story and we're amazing journalists, pat ourselves on the back. But it's like, we put this out there and things almost get sadder.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so there's no huzzah. There's no, triumphant moment for our plucky hero who's been fighting so hard. Mm. It's like with heavy hearts that they even have to do the right thing. Yeah. Because they understand the weight of it. So, like I said, much like there's no villain, I'm kind of on the fact that there's no hero.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, it
there's almost heroes.
There's almost heroes.
They're not
kind of like there's
heroes.
Almost, you know, there's all villains. Yeah. And there's almost singular villain. And so
they're all heroes. Like, and not all, but for the most part, they're all heroes. They all had that one moment where they do the right thing at the right time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's often a small thing they had to do at the right time that together pushes it over.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So, so I felt it was just true to the rest of the narrative. You know,
yeah.
And the, like I said, in much the way, the same way you're going to blame everybody for letting the problem go on.
Yeah.
There's no one person who just Aaron Brockovich'd like the story.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Well, with that, Elijah, I want to give you a chance to any final thoughts, anything that you didn't get a chance to mention?
No, I don't think so. I will say that I've seen the movie three times, like I said, and mostly it's because I had such a hard time dealing with it. It's hard to deal with, you know, especially if you work like I do. I mean, I work for a seminary training pastors, you know, and to own up to your own complicitness in the systems that allow this kind of thing. They allow this thing. That's really hard. And, I've watched it three times just trying to figure it out, you know, and I don't have answers for like what my particular role is in helping fix some of this and make this right, you know, but, I'm definitely committed to it, to figuring it out, you know, it's heavy. It is. If you're honest about your own participation in the systemic problem, it's heavy.
Yeah. Which is great, because that's what it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good for it, for being that.
Alan, any final thoughts?
Well, my final thought was, I think that actually I want to, you know, again, we don't know much about this subject until you watch a movie like this or it's real and personal, but I think that the church could actually... the church at large, particular churches, could use this as an opportunity to minister to people who have been affected by sexual abuse. So I just remember watching the movie Saving Private Ryan, walking out of the movie and feeling horrible for my two grandfathers who served in World War II, in that Battle of the Bulge. And how I remember, even at the time, they were talking about the kind of counseling that was made available after the movie. I wish if I could write the director or the company that produced it, I would say, I wish one of your final scenes were, if this has affected you, please call this number or please go to this website. I think that would have been a helpful, hopeful, positive thing in a sea of just awfulness. So that's the one thing I wish, or that's my comment, is if they cared enough to tell this story, I wish they would have cared enough to actually offer the little extra help for people, because and I'm long-winded, but let me tell you why. So I go to watch this movie at 10:20 at night, and there's two of us in the movie. So the whole time I'm wondering, why is the other person in this movie here?
Are they going to podcast on it too?
Probably not. So I'm wondering, yeah. You know, maybe they're here because something happened to them. And this is the only time when they think they can probably go watch this movie and, you know, deal with the content. Mm-hmm. So I just, that was the pastoral sense in me, my final comment, I guess, about the movie.
No, I think that's fair. And I think it's good. It's, I really like the Saving Private Ryan kind of reference too. You know, it's like movies have a way of affecting us in a way that almost nothing else can.
That's right.
Actually, I think I was just watching Trumbo recently, and one of the characters in Trumbo talking about Trumbo, who was a screenwriter making movies, you know, allegedly for communist reasons. But one of the things he says in response to somebody being like, he's spreading communism through movies, you know, har, har, har. And he says, movies are the most powerful influence ever created.
Agreed.
You know, while that was probably like a gut reaction or maybe even a little bit of hyperbole, I think it's pretty close to true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've said it plenty of times before that people are, you know, paying to go see these movies when they barely want to get up on Sunday to go to church.
Right. Yeah.
So they have incredible power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my final thought. So with that, very last thing, Elijah and Alan, I'm so glad that you guys could be here to have this conversation, carve out a little bit of your time. And I want to make sure people can either continue this conversation or get in touch with you or follow what you do. So Elijah, what do you do and how can people follow you?
So I work for Real Spirituality at Fuller Theological Seminary. You can see my regular film reviews at realspirituality.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Elijah Davidson. And like I said, I also have an article, I don't know when it's going to come out, going to be in Christianity Today about Spotlight and about how I've kind of wrestled with it since seeing it back in November. So you can keep an eye out for that.
Awesome. And obviously you'll link to that through your Twitter account and stuff.
Yeah.
So definitely follow you on Twitter. Alan, I know you're a big Twitterer. you have tweeted once or twice.
Maybe once or twice. Literally. So I'm a pastor of Church of the Redeemer in Greensboro, North Carolina. RedeemerGSO.org. And you can email me from that page. You know, I like to participate in this blog. I'm actually writing a quarterly blog for the Fresh Expressions website, freshexpressions.us.org, I believe is the address. So anyway, that's how you can get in touch with me.
All right, cool. And we'll make sure we have all those ways to contact them in the show notes. And make sure you do get in contact with them. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Obviously, you can follow the show and all. You can find the show notes, this podcast, and everything else you want to do at realworldtheology.com. And again, I would be remiss to say that we were not very, very grateful, especially for this specific conversation, to have these very, very good guests on. So again, please, please get in contact with them, follow them, keep the conversation going, explore this. It's good to not let it be forgotten so easily. Thank you, listeners, for listening to us have this discussion, and please have some of your own. Until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!